Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark, and I'm joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Edward Luce, who is a senior writer at the Financial Times, and we are delighted to welcome him back. So, first topic, the VP debate and the response to it. So there were reactions from professional political watchers who said that J.D. Vance once again shape-shifted and turned himself into a competent and seemingly somewhat even appealing character, whereas Walz struggled. On the other hand, the immediate snap polls that were conducted by CBS and by CNN and others found that voters were pretty much divided right down the middle as to who won and who lost. So, Ed Luce, I'd like your reaction to the debate. First of all, how did you evaluate that contrast, you know, between what elite opinion thought and what voters thought?
It's a really good question. I'm sort of more in line with the elite opinion in that I don't think Governor Walz is a very good debater, and I think Vance is a very effective shape shifter. I mean, he is kind of that fantasy that people used to have about Ron DeSantis amongst certain non-Trump Republicans, that he is Trumpian without being Trump. Appeared to be civil. He appeared to be genial. He did come across as genial, and he appeared to be rational. I mean, and this is not, of course, to minimize the sort of string of whopping lies that he told, and his evasiveness over January the 6th, his whataboutism over changing the topic to censorship, etc. But he has been doing the Sunday morning shows for the last few weeks, and Tim Walz hasn't. And that showed. That showed. I felt Vance was ready for prime time. The only thing I would say is a sort of silver lining. Is that as everybody here knows, Linda, Damon, and Bill in particular, vice presidential debates don't really matter that much, generally, historically speaking. And this one I don't think is going to matter hugely. Arguably, it was the third most important campaign-related event on Tuesday. The most important was 250 Iranian missiles heading towards Israel. The second was probably Kamala Harris agreeing to do 60 Minutes. Next Monday, a very highly watched show, and Trump pulling out from doing 60 Minutes. And I would put Vance Walz third on that list of significant events on Tuesday.
Yeah, that's a very, very good perspective. So Bill Galston, though, I remember it was a few weeks ago we were discussing Tucker Carlson's disgusting elevation of this so-called popular historian who was distorting the Second World War and saying that that actually, you know, the Holocaust was just an accident and that Churchill was the true villain, et cetera. And I remember you saying, you know, that Vance, you know, would absolutely have to sever his ties with Carlson and not appear with him. And of course, he didn't do any of that. He did appear with Carlson. And one of the missed opportunities, I have to say, at this debate was that Walz failed to mention it at all, could have held Vance's feet to the fire about that and other things. What did you make of it?
Of course, I agree with you, because agreeing with you is agreeing with myself. Having said that, I think a couple of things about the debate. Number one, this is the closest presidential election I have ever seen. And the state that will determine the outcome is literally tied as of this morning.
Pennsylvania.
And as a result, any small perturbation in the atmosphere over the Yukon, whether induced by a butterfly or a vice presidential debate, could make the difference. I think there were two effects of this debate. Number one, it will make Trump look better because he selected J.D. Vance. People are judged not only by the company they keep, but the company they make. And secondly, this has elevated Vance into the future of the Republican Party. One way or another, this debate has really put him in the driver's seat for the future. If the ticket wins, you know, Trump can only serve another term, and then Vance has pole position. And if Trump loses, Vance, I think, has advanced his prospects very considerably in these 90 minutes. So the future of the MAGA movement, I think, was affected by this debate. And that perhaps is its most significant consequence.
Linda, when Kamala Harris was interviewing potential VP picks, the story is that Walz warned her that he was not a good debater. I think he demonstrated that. But so it seems to me that he was determined, because he knew he didn't have the skills of a good debater, that he was going to lean into the nice guy, you know, authenticity lane. And unfortunately, part of the way he chose to do that was by extending grace to Vance and saying things like, well, I know you also care about this issue, and I know you too are, you know, which was completely misplaced. I mean, he could have tried to show that he's an ordinary good fellow from, you know, Minnesota Nice and all that, without giving Vance this opportunity to also seem nice. What do you think?
Well, first of all, you know, I have called J.D. Vance a chameleon, and he showed that he was a chameleon last night. And the thing about chameleons is that they blend in with their surroundings. So you had Minnesota Nice on stage, and it would have been really bad if the chameleon had turned into a fire-breathing dragon and had displayed the kind of temperament he has on various other programs and formats, you know, the cat ladies and the migrants eating cats and dogs and then hanging around with the Holocaust deniers and or at least
Christian nationalists, right?
Christian nationalists, all of that. So I think that worked to his disadvantage. But let me just say, I don't think he was terrible. I don't think
you mean Walz.
I don't think it was a disaster of a debate.
Right.
I think he speaks the way ordinary people do. And Vance demonstrated his Yale training. He, you know, he's an attorney. He went to Yale. He's well spoken. And he spoke in complete sentences and paragraphs, all of which served him well. And I think Walz bumbled around a bit, including what I thought was the worst moment of the debate, when he was asked directly if he had exaggerated by saying that he was in China during the Tiananmen Square uprising, which he was not. And just, you know, having, he should have just started with saying, I misspoke. You know, I sometimes do that. Next question. And of course, he was in China that summer, that that occurred. But he didn't do that. But I,
that was the stupidest. Excuse me. That was the stupidest question, and only matched by the stupidity of the answer.
Right.
Honestly.
Right.
I mean, it was such a non-issue. Yeah. It's like, oh, it was a few weeks before or after.
Right. Yeah.
So
what?
Yeah. And who did it hurt? It didn't hurt anyone. Whereas J.D. Vance's lies about
shut down schools,
immigrants. Yes, exactly. Right. Caused it. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So at any rate, so I don't think it was as awful as it could have been. And I think he did very well at the end of the debate when he pushed J.D. on whether or not he accepted the results of the 2020 election. And I think Vance's non-answer was much more important than Waltz's sort of dancing around whether he was in on Tiananmen Square, you know.
Yeah. No, okay. Yeah, Damon, so you could boil this down to that final, alas, it came 90 minutes or so into the debate, but that confrontation where Waltz did hold Vance's feet to the fire and just looked at him straight and said, who won the 2020 election? And that Vance refused to answer and said, I'm looking toward the future. And honestly, at that moment, he really looked struggling. So you could say that that is really all you need to know, that Vance is a person who, well, you need to know a little bit more. Here's what he said to Ross Douthat, who asked him about this very thing and about certifying, because he has said that if he had been in Mike Pence's shoes in 2020, he would not have certified the election and he would have allowed a political debate to ensue about it. He said, we never had a political debate. Wow. So that is an invitation to a constitutional crisis. And that is the most important thing to know about Vance, is that he will not obey the U.S. Constitution if it's inconvenient for Donald Trump. So is that the takeaway from the debate in the end, despite all of Waltz's, you know, awkwardnesses and whatnot?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I already, because I read that Ross Douthat interview with Vance a few months ago, I already knew very clearly that he was planning on heading in to this adventure, though he had not yet been tapped to be vice president. The reason the interview ran is because he was on a short list, and he was tapped. I've known from the beginning, we've all known if we read that interview, that his line on this is going to be that, in fact, there were real questions about that election that should have been adjudicated in the public realm. In other words, allow the certification of the votes, not go through, have alternative slates of electors be proposed in some states, and then fight it out in Congress, I guess. Which is a horribly irresponsible response. And you agree with that, Mona. Everyone on this podcast, I think, agrees substantively that this is atrocious. But was it the biggest, most important takeaway from the evening last night at the debate? I don't think so if we're talking about it as a political event. First of all, this exchange happened at the very end. The debate was listed repeatedly by CBS as lasting 90 minutes, and this happened an hour and 45 minutes in. I don't understand why they decided it was a good idea to undersell the length of the event and then to overshoot it. But it happened very deep in. And secondly, I mean, I don't think that this issue matters with the pressing importance to the average American voter as it does to all of us, in the same way that we don't exactly agree with what the polling shows the response to the debate was. You know, again, it seemed to be more of a draw in the polls, whereas we all tend to agree that Vance did better than Walls. On this issue, too, I think that it is very important to me to have it confirmed once again that Vance will use all of the talent, all of the capacity to juggle complex policy ideas and details and synthesize them in real time before a live audience of tens of millions, that he will use those skills to have the back of Donald Trump, no matter what Trump does. That is hugely important to me, even though it isn't much of a surprise at this point. But whether it makes any kind of difference in the wider electorate, I'm a little skeptical about that. One last thing I'll say about that whole segment that hasn't been mentioned is that in addition to sticking with this line that there were real issues with the vote count that should have been adjudicated in Congress, he also pivoted to this free speech argument, which you know, I'm all in favor of a lot of free speech. And I thought that Walz's response to essentially say, yeah, there was disinformation and so forth, like as if, you know, disagreeing about COVID regulations was the equivalent to yelling fire in a crowded movie theater. I thought that whole segment was really bad, but the worst part of it was that Vance tried to do the switcheroo by changing it to that debate. That's a valid thing to put on the topic for discussion, but it is nowhere near the gravity of what Trump attempted. And to say that Trump, you know, he's no threat to democracy because he left on January 20th. Well, sure, after his self-coup attempt failed. Oh, yeah. Great. All right. Well, maybe it'll fail the next time too. At least we can hope. So,
yeah. 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 And Ed, he also he said that that Trump told his supporters to peacefully protest. And of course, you know, he said peacefully once in that speech and, you know, said fight like 20 times. So, you know, I mean, that is just it's utterly preposterous. It's true gaslighting to stand up there and tell the world that Trump was simply trying to encourage a peaceful protest at that moment. And then, of course, as the thing was unfolding, Trump threw fuel on the fire by releasing a tweet saying that Mike Pence failed to do his duty as the chant, you know, the chanting mob is saying, hang Mike Pence. I mean, it's truly mind boggling. That's not the only thing he misrepresented. He also said, again, very smooth, very fluid, JD, you know, bright guy. He also said that Donald Trump saved Obamacare. you know, he also compared, he said it was rich that Democrats were accusing Republicans of being anti-democratic when Democratic leaders had refused to accept previous elections. You know, the fact that Hillary Clinton, you know, said 2 years later that Putin tried to help Trump get reelected, I mean, she conceded the election. I mean, she appeared at the inauguration. I mean, you know, the whole thing is just, I'm sorry. It's just, do you have any comment on my rant?
Yeah, I was actually there at whatever it was, 10 a.m. the morning after in 2016 when Hillary conceded.
Oh, okay. There you go.
You know, the whopping lies he told, I mean, another being that he'd never been for a federal abortion ban.
Right.
It's like, this has been a sort of core plank of him throughout all his shifts and changes from being anti-Trump to pro-Trump. He's stuck with that one. He is a hardcore Christian nationalist. So the frustration, you know, with Governor Walz not, I mean, these are sort of like lobbing a ball at the batter, and he just missed a few of them, unfortunately. Sincerity with which he lies. Linda's right to call it a chameleon-like skill, but you know, chameleonism is a skill of politicians. And he has that skill. These were whopping lies, and they appeared to be perfectly reasonable differences of point of view. If you're a low information, undecided voter, God knows what makes you undecided at this point. But if you're one of those, you know, handful of a million Americans who hasn't yet made up their mind and believes that, well, we need more information from Harris Walz. And we've got all the information we need from Trump Vance, that being a pretty preposterous summary, but politics is not fair. If that's the people that are being aimed at, who are clearly low information, I'm not sure Vance didn't do a good job. And the whopping lies were not called out. And us telling each other and, you know, posting on X or whatever it might be, or discussing on cable shows, the degree and magnitude of Vance's lies is not going to reach those people. So I'm a little worried about Vance's great political skill, and how many people observed it and drew something from it.
Yeah. Linda, my reactions to debates, I recognize, are frequently not those of the average voter. I've seen this. It's all happened often enough that I've come to accept it. So with that in mind, I will say that though I found Walls less than convincing, and I found his stumbles. At one point, he found himself saying that he had befriended school shooters. He talked about Israel and its proxies when he clearly meant Iran and its proxies. Israel doesn't have proxies, etc. So he messed up a lot. And one thing that he did, you know, where they were talking about the high cost of housing, and he blamed, so of course Vance blames it on immigrants, because they blame everything on immigrants. But Walls blamed it on basically Wall Street speculators. It was a moment where you really, I felt, just looking at this, you know, pulling the lens out, leaving aside the issues about democracy, which are foremost, but both these candidates were attempting to bribe the voters, right? Nobody is ever going to have to pay for anything. The Republicans are going to provide you with childcare and housing and jobs and security and the finest military in the world. It's all going to be paid for by magic tariffs that will be levied on other countries. We won't pay the tariffs. On the other hand, the Democrats are saying the rich, it's the rich who are going to pay their fair share, and nobody ever has to pay for anything.
Yeah, it is a little amazing how many kudos are being thrown toward this debate and how civil.
Oh, it was so civil.
Policy. We had all these policy discussions. You know, I'm not going to use an epithet on here to describe it, but let us just say it was BS. That is just not true. Let me talk for a minute about the whole housing thing, because I do find this fascinating that immigrants are being blamed for the housing crisis. I don't think J.D. Vance has been on a construction site recently. If he had, no matter where in the country he would go, he would see a whole lot of those workers are, in fact, foreign-born. It's about a third of the construction industry is made up of foreign-born workers.
And they have a shortage right now, don't they?
They have a shortage. They can't find workers in Texas or other places. When they have these hurricanes come through, you know, who's going to get in there to help rebuild them? So they're talking about deporting this enormous number, 25 million, which is not just a made up number. It's a very pernicious number because it includes not only the 11 million undocumented people who we know are in the United States, they're probably more like 12 million now. The 11 million figure comes from 2022. But it is also talking about the people who've been given legal status here, the Ukrainians, the Afghans, not just the Mexicans and Salvadorans and Haitians and Venezuelans. They're talking about deporting a lot of people who are legally here. So, you know, it's, I guess, good there are going to be some empty houses available, because there aren't going to be any houses built if they get rid of all of these immigrants that they want to deport. But I find it really dispiriting that, you know, yeah, they don't have to fact check them, but it would be good to have a little bit of command of the facts here. And that is where I think Tim Walz did fail. I mean, he didn't seem to know this. He didn't seem to be able to use it to his advantage. And nobody ever calls Trump out when he makes these outlandish claims. And Vance is now making them too. And frankly, Vance should know better.
Bill Galston, exactly. He does know better. And that's what makes Vance a little alarming. I mean, I find Vance, I put him in a category with Tucker Carlson, where these are very bright people, and I find them more menacing than, you know, 1,000 Paul Gosars. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
A friend of mine, you know, famously characterized, you know, Trump as malevolence undercut by incompetence. And
the I think that was Ben Wittes, the friend of the pod.
But the combination of malevolence and competence is truly scary.
Yes. No, exactly.
I do have a couple of points to make. One, it suddenly strikes me that the one Chinese import that we really need is a few million of their vacant apartments. we could just think, I mean, there was a huge article this morning, in the Times or someplace, to the effect that, as their population declines, they're now looking at potentially 90 million vacant housing units by 2050. 90 million, right? they can build, we can't. Okay, now here's the second point I want to make. I made myself extremely unpopular a few weeks ago when I went on one of my rare rants about Harris's decision to choose Walls rather than Josh Shapiro. Now, I appeal to that same audience. Do you think that J.D. Vance would have gotten away with a tenth of what he got away with if it had been Josh Shapiro on that stage? The state that will resolve the election this year, Pennsylvania, as I've already mentioned, is a dead tie. If Donald Trump becomes president by a margin of 20,000 votes in Pennsylvania, how are you all going to feel?
Yeah. Okay. One last thing on this topic to you, Damon. One thing that Walls could have done is he could have pointed out that just in the wake of this natural disaster, this awful Hurricane Helene, Trump and Vance have been attempting to use it to divide, to sow anger through lies, through claiming, for example, that the governor of Georgia couldn't get the president on the telephone, which the governor of Georgia immediately corrected and denied. He had spoken to Biden the previous day, etc. He could have said that it is not just that this kind of division and hatred that they are injecting into American politics is exactly what is so dangerous about them. And instead, he helped Vance burnish his image as actually fairly reasonable and willing to agree on gun control or something. Actually, he didn't agree on gun control. He said we needed to harden schools or something, door control. But anyway, it seems to me would have been the way for Walls to go. Admittedly, before everybody, please, all you commenters, don't write to me. I know he had some good moments. I concede that, but it just pained me that Vance comes out of this looking, whereas he is, he has become an incredibly divisive and damaging figure in American politics, and he comes out of this debate looking like, the future leader of the MAGA forces, as Bill was saying.
Well, I mean, I'll quickly say that, yeah, sure. I mean, there are all kinds of things that Walls could have, should have done better. My initial response to his performance was, meh, it was fine. And a lot of it had to do with a kind of insecurity, nervousness, kind of unsure about how to draw on information he was probably drilled with in all the debate prep. He just wasn't that quick with it. And that included with a lot of responses to J.D. Vance's exaggerations and lies. But I actually did want to make a slightly different point because it seems like there's a true consensus here, and I want to beg to differ on something, even if it puts puts me in the conventional wisdom elsewhere. I actually think that the debate was, in fact, a very encouraging thing. And it was a huge improvement over pretty much every presidential level political event that we've had in this country since Donald Trump emerged on the scene. I do think it's very important to always keep Trump as the standard of how bad it can get. I wrote an op-ed column for the Times early on, very early on in the whole Republican presidential cycle this last time, arguing that yes, Ron DeSantis is bad, but Trump is still worse. And a lot of liberals were furious at me for this, for precisely something that Bill just said offhand a few minutes ago, that like, being a competent, malevolent actor is worse than being an incompetent one. Well, I don't know if that's entirely true. I actually think that having a moron who's emotionally incontinent in the Oval Office is a uniquely terrible thing. And what we saw last night, despite all the lies and exaggerations from Vance, still was vastly, vastly better than any debate we have ever seen in which Donald Trump was a participant, because they actually had a conversation about policy. They went back and forth. They talked, both of them, not just Walz to Vance, as it sometimes sounded in this discussion, but mutually. Vance frequently said, yes, Governor Walz, I agree. That's a good point. You made several good points. I can agree with that. Kind of affirmations of bipartisanship on abortion. They tried to reach some kind of a common ground or understanding of each other on guns. They did the same thing. And on down the line, and compared to what we get from Trump, which is just a volcanic eruption of bitterness and anger and grievances and resentment and ignorance about all things on policy, this was a step up. And frankly, if Vance is the future of the Republican Party after Trump, I will be considerably less worried about this country's present and future than I am right now with Trump still in the center of it.
Okay. So we could have a whole other panel just on that comment. Thank you for that. I would just say real quick, taking the privilege of the moderator to say that as much as I loathe and despise the level of idiocy and rage and nonsense that Trump brings to everything that he participates in, I think that you are putting a little too much weight on appearances here, because Vance has said that his advice this was September 2021. He said he had one piece of advice for Trump in a second term. It would be fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state. Replace them with our people. And when the courts stop you, stand before the country like Andrew Jackson did and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling. Now let him enforce it. That is very dangerous stuff. And by the way, there's no evidence Jackson said that, but that's not important. But the fact is that is the kind of lawlessness that Trump has unleashed in the Republican Party. And so even though Vance made a big show of seeming civil and of seeming to be playing but more by the rules, these kinds of quotations are just reveal who he is willing to be in other settings, and that's really worrying.
Do you mind if I say one quick thing?
Yes, sure.
I mean, depending on which day it is, I could agree with Damon or not agree with him. Today is not the day I agree with him, but I could change by tomorrow. But just to ask the question, what is the political philosophy of Peter Thiel? Peter Thiel, who is Vance's sponsor, I think is as near as we get to a full-blown organized fascist.
Yes.
In today's America. And he means it, and because he's consistently been saying it for 20 years, the democracy and capitalism are not compatible. And it's democracy that has to go. And I think Vance is a genuine student of and protege of Peter Thiel.
Well, I mean, I would briefly just say in response, I'm no fan of Peter Thiel. I've written about him and his menacing influence. I also think it's true that he and Vance were quite close long before Vance made his MAGA shift. He was the old Vance of sort of a Reagan-Bush conservative when they became close, when Thiel hired Vance to work at one of his investment shops, and even right up to the eve of Vance launching his Senate campaign, which was largely funded by Thiel. And so I don't think it's quite that you can treat him as a kind of, you know, a creation of Thiel's mind set out into the mm-hmm. world.
Okay, great. Let's hear a word from one of our sponsors. Are you concerned about the growing political divide in America? Then it's time to tune in to the Vital Center podcast. Hosted by Jeffrey Cabaservice of the Niskanen Center, this engaging show explores solutions to our nation's most pressing issues. From combating climate change to advancing social welfare, the Vital Center podcast provides a moderate perspective on political issues and draws on historical context to make sense of the world today. You'll hear from policy experts, academics, and thought leaders as they discuss innovative ideas to bridge the gap between left and right. Each episode of the Vital Center dives deep into historical trends and modern-day solutions, equipping you with the knowledge to better understand today's political dynamics. Subscribe to the Vital Center podcast wherever you get your podcasts and rediscover the power of pragmatic politics in action. We thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right, I'd like to have a few words about something that Ed mentioned at the top, namely the war between Israel and Iran. And I'm going to start with you, Ed. It is being described as an escalation on Israel's part. But I wonder if that's really the correct way to view it, considering that Iran is the prime mover here. It is Iran that has placed its proxies around Israel, Hezbollah in the north, Hamas on the south, the Houthis further beyond, where they are firing on Israel, they are attacking Israel, and when Israel strikes back, it's called escalation. So is that, am I mischaracterizing it, or how do you view it?
I will tiptoe gently through the minefield of the question you've laid out for me. I have to say, when Bill talks about, you know, whether it's wind in the Yukon or a butterfly wing somewhere affecting this very close election, you know, the whoosh of F-35s in the Levant, I think is going to be and it is already impactful on this election. Iran undoubtedly has proxy groups in Yemen and in with Hezbollah, Hamas, etc., that wish for Israel's elimination. That has always been the case. That didn't suddenly, you know, become true last week. It has been true for many, many years. And before Hezbollah, there were groups that were similar to Hezbollah. I think the question here about the timing of the taking out of Nasrallah last week, somebody who very much deserved to be taken out, who was a leader of the largest non-state military force in the world, but also a terrorist organization. The timing of this is, I think, more related to Netanyahu's political survival than it is to an objective Israeli measurement of when the time is ripe or when the time is not ripe. And we can debate that endlessly. I mean, it is true, and we forget this because so much is happening in the world, that the last Iranian president, a relative hardliner, Raisi, died in a helicopter crash in May. A new Iranian president was elected who is a moderate and has been trying to sort of get back into the nuclear deal since then. He's now been completely undercut. The legs have just gone from him. The sort of expression of moderation, we wish to re-engage with the world, we wish to grow, that the Iranian electorate sent, which meant getting back into the Iran nuclear deal, that is now sort of dead. So my great fear here is this October surprise. It's not a surprise, but my great fear here is that the time is as ripe as it has ever been for an attack, an attempt to decapitate the Iranian regime. I think Netanyahu will do what it takes to prolong and perhaps in this case have a shot at history. But certainly more in the more immediate situation to prolong his job as Israel's prime minister. With 5 weeks to go to the American election, Biden's giving mixed signals. So at best, there's a sort of flickering amber light. Some in the administration think one thing, others think another. Depends on who you talk to. Is it Brett McGurk? Is it Jake Sullivan? Is it Tony Blinken? Is it Bill Burns? You're going to get different nuances from each of them. And an amber light, a flickering amber light, even if it sometimes flickers red to Netanyahu, is a green light. And if Trump wins this election, he knows full well there will be a green, bright green light every single day of a Trump administration for whatever Netanyahu wants to do. So I guess this is sort of more my parochial filtering it back to a subject on which I feel more confident, which is how this plays in America. I'm not a Middle Eastern expert, and I'm fearful of providing any deeper sort of verdicts on the timing of this than I've ventured.
So Linda, one of the things that people struggle with when interpreting events there is that nobody trusts Netanyahu's motives. So that is an issue, right? Because he does have mixed motives here. You know, arguably he has prolonged the war in Gaza because he knew that the end of the war meant an election and possibly the end of his term in office. So that is a huge, huge part of the picture, but it's not the whole picture. The fact is that since October 7th, Hezbollah has been raining missiles down, 9,000 missiles on the northern part of Israel. Between 60 and 100,000 Israelis have been displaced from their homes in the north. They cannot live there, as one can't when missiles are flying down. And so in a sense, you know, the Israelis are simply saying, look, we're under attack from the south. We're under attack from the north. If we don't respond, then that signals weakness and we will continue to be attacked. We have no choice. That's how do you view it?
Well, first of all, I very much applaud the taking out of Nasrallah. And I think the hits, the individual, you know, blowing up telephones, or not telephones, but pagers. And walkie-talkies, all of that was very successful. I do worry about ground troops growing in. It has not worked well for Israel in the past when they've gone in with troops to Lebanon. So I think that needs to be avoided. What I am wondering right now, though, is after those 250 ICBMs, although none of them really did what they were supposed to do in taking out the Mossad or any other military installation, it could be an excuse for Israel to do something that I think does have to do with timing. I think that Netanyahu is worried about the election. He is worried that Kamala Harris may not be as good a friend as Joe Biden has been, whether that's reasonable or not to worry about. I think he is worried. And therefore, he may see this as his one opportunity to strike a fatal blow to Iran's nuclear program. And a retaliation for those 250 rockets could be an attack on the infrastructure for the nuclear program, and he may decide he has to do that. And that is going to be big. It could lead to regime change in Iran, but it could also lead to Israel losing support from its allies in the West. So I'm worried about it. But frankly, if they have a shot at taking out the nuclear program, if they have a shot at regime change in Iran, who could fault them for wanting to take it?
Damon, there's so many unknowns here. I've been under the impression for a long time that Israel didn't have the capacity to hit Iran's nuclear facilities, because if they did, they would have done it. But they do have the capacity to hit, you know, their oil refineries and the ports where the oil is exported. I mean, they could do a lot of damage. Meanwhile, these Hezbollah missiles, which I read, by one account, I read that Israel's already taken out half of them. The Hezbollah missiles were supposed to be Iran's insurance policy to make sure that Israel couldn't attack Iran directly without risking a barrage from Hezbollah, Iran's cat's paw. So respond to any of that if you like. Do you think that this is, as Linda says, motivated, that part of what's going on here is that Netanyahu thinks he has a window now and that it could be closing? Is that what you think?
Well, I don't. I mean, I'll be honest and say I don't know. I have no inside tips from the Netanyahu circle about what his motives are. I know that he's wanted to get rid of Iran's nuclear program for a very long time. He's warned about it for literally decades. On the other hand, he has historically been quite cautious about doing big military things. Now, what we've seen over the past 3 weeks or so maybe shows that he's become more emboldened, because these have been pretty spectacular acts. And if he actually does go after Iran directly in the coming days, that would be a huge shift for him, I think. But it would, in a way, be a fulfillment of something that he's dreamed of doing for a very long time. And just on the issue of the domestic political scene in Israel, I think I've been right on board with everyone on this podcast all along for the last year, since October 7th of last year, in talking about suspicions about Netanyahu, his motives, his seemingly bottomless cynicism and willingness to come up with military plans with his own personal fate very much in the foreground. But the hard reality is that his prospects are improving markedly. Gideon Saar, who's a rival of his, has now joined his government. If he can get someone else to join his government as well, that would then insulate him from the fear that the two radical right members who cause him so much grief, both politically and in terms of his PR around the world, they could be ditched. You know, if there were an election held tomorrow, I wouldn't bet against him surviving, because the Israeli public is not going to vote for anyone left of center at all. So it's going to be a right-leaning government. And if you could cobble together a Netanyahu-Likud coalition with people other than the far-right fascists who are in there now, I could see that succeeding at the polls. I think the moment of his maximal weakness is in the past now. Now, of course, this could be changed if they attack Iran and it doesn't go well and the whole region explodes and some of these missiles actually start killing Israeli citizens on the ground, which so far, thank goodness, they have not because of the Iron Dome. Then all bets are off. I don't know how Netanyahu's prospects would hold up at that point. But at the moment, I'm duly impressed with his survivability. He's the proverbial cat with nine lives, and I think he has two or three left.
Bill, I would go even further than Damon and say not only does Netanyahu, is he showing that he's got nine lives, but that right now, honestly, Israel was reeling after October 7th, and there were terrible failures that allowed October 7th to happen. But in the last month, Israel has demonstrated remarkable, remarkable strength. And there's no way that any electorate could be seeing that and not be impressed. I mean, the attacks on their enemies have been so effective and so demoralizing to Iran. Iran has now fired, first of all, it's lost Nasrallah, who, let us recall, the late unlamented Nasrallah is the guy who said that the Jews had done the world a great favor by gathering in Israel, because that way you don't have to range all over the globe to kill them. They're all conveniently located in one spot. So he is dead. Haniyeh is dead in a mission that, again, is just jaw-droppingly impressive. They assassinated Haniyeh in Tehran. And then when these barrages of ballistic missiles came over Israel's defensive systems, which is the David's Sling and the Iron Dome, and I think the Arrow system is the other one, have been remarkably effective. And so I am kind of in awe of Israel's performance in the last month. And sometimes you have to say that winning matters.
Sure beats losing.
Yeah.
Look, I agree with you, and time is short. So I will just make a very brief point. Israel is not sworn to Iran's destruction, but Iran is sworn to Israel's destruction. And I don't think that's just a figure of speech or a piece of rhetoric to rally the troops. If and when Iran gets the capacity to obliterate Israel, they will probably use it. And no Israeli prime minister can afford to assume that they won't. So as we argue about details and tactics, my question is, if you were Israel's leader, what would you do? And Netanyahu can be criticized for prolonging the Palestinian question, justly. But do you really think that the Iranian desire to obliterate the Jewish state from the face of the earth is contingent on a two-state solution in Palestine? I don't believe that for a moment. This is blind, destructive hatred.
Religious fanaticism.
And there's nothing to be done about that except to strike it, and if possible, destroy it.
All right. On that note, we will turn to our other sponsor of the week. Well, it is autumn, and so you're thinking of climbing into bed in a nice, comfortable set of sheets, and I highly recommend you try out Miracle Made. Miracle Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver-infused fabrics that are temperature-regulating, so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. These sheets are self-cooling, as I mentioned. Again, those silver-infused fabrics, inspired by NASA, make them thermoregulating. They're comfortable on your skin and without the high price tag of other luxury brands. They feel as nice, if not nicer, than sheets used by some five-star hotels. So go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made Sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. If you use our promo code BEGTODIFFER at checkout, you'll also get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer and use the code BEGTODIFFER to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/begtodiffer. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. And with that, because we went long discussing the vice presidential debate, we're going to skip our third topic and we're going to skip our highlight or low light of the week, unless everybody could get them in like 30 seconds each. If you could all know, okay. In that case, we're going to hold off on that. I'm going to tease it for next week. We're going to be discussing our favorite TV shows or movies that we want to recommend to you all to help relax as we get through this campaign season. That will have to wait until next week. For now, thanks to Ed Luce for joining us. Lovely to have you, and to all the regulars, as well as our wonderful producer, Jim Swift, and of course, all of our viewers and listeners. Beg to Differ will return next week as every week.